Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You've still got to hand it to the banks. At least that's Ben Bernanke's view. But while the banks will keep getting full plates of cheap cash, that leaves savers hungry for whatever they can find. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad you're here on this, the 24th of February. Don't bother stopping me if you've heard this before. Low interest rates are here to stay for a while. Fed Chief Ben Bernanke delivered his latest monetary forecast on Capitol Hill today, calling for 0% short-term interest rates for banks, which doesn't improve the outlook for a return on your savings. As our John Dimsdale reports from Washington, this long financial drought could be pushing savers into more risky investments.
Ben Bernanke said there's still way too much slack in the economy, with stubborn unemployment and a struggling real estate market. There's also no sign of inflation, and that means the Federal Open Market Committee will keep interest rates right where they are. Here it is in Fed speak.
The FOMC continues to anticipate that economic conditions, including low rates of resource utilization, subdued inflation trends, and stable inflation expectations, are likely to warrant exceptionally low levels of the federal funds rate for an extended period.
But when banks can get cheap money from the Fed, they don't pay savers much for their deposits. Low returns have hit just as Americans are reacting to the credit crunch by saving more.
It does create the temptation to, quote, stretch for yield.
Jeffrey Cosnett is a senior editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance magazine. He says some investors are lured by returns on corporate junk bonds or real estate trusts.
But this is more suitable if you're in your 30s or your 40s, and you have many years to catch up if you have any more stumbles.
For those with a shorter time horizon, financial planner Don Patrick at Integrated Financial Group advises patience.
If we're in a very low interest rate environment, 1%, 2%, 3%, let's say, just be happy with that for a few years. Most likely, in a couple of years, interest rates will start creeping up. Then you can go out and get your 5, 10-year bonds or get longer maturity CDs.
Fed officials say it'll be months before the central bank starts raising interest rates. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I am deeply sorry. Those four simple words were the starting point today for the head of the world's largest automaker. Akio Toyoda delivered his apology to a packed congressional hearing room. He took full responsibility for that series of safety lapses which have led to deadly runaway crashes.
As you well know, I am the grandson of the founder. And all the Toyota vehicles bear my name. For me, when the cars are damaged, it is as though I am as well.
Toyota candidly suggested his company grew too fast and got its priorities confused, and he vowed that will change.
Management will make responsible decisions from the perspective of customer safety first.
The Toyota chief is pledging to improve the way consumer complaints are handled and seek greater input from outside safety experts. Google executives are on the hook for a much different issue of corporate responsibility, a privacy ruling against the company that came down in Milan, Italy today. Three top Google officials got 6-month suspended sentences for allowing a video to be posted on the Google video site showing an emotionally disturbed boy being bullied. The case highlights deep-seated differences over Internet freedom and privacy. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Back in 2006, some Italian bullies filmed themselves beating up a boy with autism, then posted the video to Google. The company pulled it down 2 months later when they were contacted by Italian police, then helped catch and convict the attackers.
But that wasn't good enough for the Italian government.
Art Brodsky is with the group Public Knowledge.
They felt that the Google executives, none of whom had anything to do with this video, should also be held accountable.
The court found the executives criminally liable for the video, basically saying the company should have censored it right when it was posted and someone complained, long before Italian cops asked them to do something about it. Internet companies say that's contrary to basic rights of free expression we rely on in the U.S. It's also impractical, says Brian Cooley of CNET.
Internet providers, Twitter or Facebook or Google and its YouTube, can't be vetting everything that's posted on the web. The web has far too many posts every tenth of a second.
Google's Scott Rubin says the company will appeal.
It's a chilling decision.
Matt Zimmerman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation says the U.S. shields internet speech from government interference. In Europe, not so much.
The First Amendment provides much greater protection for free expression here than do comparable laws in Europe.
If the Italian ruling stands, Google and other sites in Europe might have to block everything from nasty restaurant reviews to political satire to protect themselves from defamation and privacy lawsuits. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you just can't miss the Olympics, you probably also haven't been able to miss NBC's big promo push for Jay Leno's return to late night. The network is busy trying to unscramble the eggs and reclaim the ratings lead it held before Conan O'Brien took over The Tonight Show. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has an update.
If you've been watching the Olympics, you've probably seen this ad, Jay Leno cruising unapologetically down the freeway, driving back into his old spot at 11:30. Whether his old viewers will get back with him is another question. Bill Carroll at the Katz Television Group says the good news for Jay Leno is he's still got a sizable core audience.
If he's back in place, they'll at least go back and sample. Now, whether they stay with him or now they've sampled Kimmel or Jon Stewart or whoever, that's tougher to get a handle on.
And remember, NBC's got Leno's old 10 o'clock hole to fill. Variety TV critic Brian Lowry says that presents a big challenge for the network.
They're going to have to start over relaunching the 10 o'clock hour. They've got Law and Order in there on one night. They've got a new drama, Parenthood, in on another. They've got a reality show with Jerry Seinfeld on Thursday. That's a lot of change to sell.
And a bomb at 10 o'clock would hurt viewership of the 11 o'clock news, which in turn would hurt Leno. Though Lowry says,
terrible lead-ins are a problem, but Leno didn't have terrific lead-ins before, and he was still winning.
There is one more factor not far from where I sit here in Midtown Manhattan. The Tonight Show's chief competition, David Letterman's Late Show on CBS, is now number one. In early February, The Late Show attracted more than 4.5 million sets of eyeballs, its highest numbers of the season. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Stocks enjoyed a Bernanke boost today. The details when we do the numbers. When it comes to the world's financial future, Greece has been called the canary in the coal mine, or as its prime minister put it recently, the guinea pig. Greece is the first developed country to embark on a major program of deficit reduction. Not by choice, mind you. Financial markets and pressure from fellow Eurozone members are forcing the country to make deep cuts in public spending. And the process is not going smoothly. Today, labor unions called their second nationwide strike this month to protest the austerity measures. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from Athens.
Tens of thousands marched through the center of Athens in protest against the pay cuts and the higher taxes. Many of the marchers said they were the victims of global financial shenanigans.
Myself, I feel humiliated by the international attack against us. It's not fair.
It is not us who created the crisis, and we don't have to be the ones who pay it to lower our salaries, to attack our working rights.
Some 30,000 protesters marched. A further 2 million people may have joined the strike. Teachers, nurses, train drivers, Athens ground to a halt. Even the glories of ancient Greece were affected.
This is the Parthenon, the most remarkable temple of the Greek Western civilization.
This guide was showing the last visitors around the Acropolis before it closed for today's action. Even the archaeologists downed their trowels and walked off excavations. Despina Kutsumba says the pay and job cuts are endangering her profession and are economically damaging too.
If the government stops hiring people for the Ministry of Culture, we won't be able to do our job. And our job is something that brings money to Greece through tourism.
But the government is under huge pressure to cut its spending. Greece has got to get its house in order, says Gikas Hardouvelis, chief economist at Greece's second biggest bank.
Economists love this situation where finally the politicians are with their backs on the wall and they have to do the right thing.
And that, he says, is to end the years of deceit about the scale of the budget deficit, cut the bloated public sector and stop widespread tax evasion. Hardouvelis reckons Greece can deliver.
It's the Europeans that are after Greece to make sure they bring down their deficits. The markets are penalizing Greece, so there is no way out. We've got to do it.
On the lively streets of the city, well away from the route of the protest march, many Athenians seem to agree. Opinion surveys show that 66% back the government cuts. Many seem fed up with the strikes. But that still leaves 2 million strikers apparently in militant mood, and that includes archaeologist Despina Koutsoumba.
Our banks had 3 billion euros profits in 2009, in the middle of the crisis. And they ask me to reduce my salary. Never.
And that's an archaeologist digging in her heels and drawing on her knowledge of Greek history.
It's a history of struggles. It's a history of wars.
Crisis is a Greek word, isn't it?
Yes, crisis is a Greek word, yeah.
And so is chaos. Today's mostly peaceful protest descended at one point into violence and vandalism. More strikes and rallies are planned. Greece's deficit reduction is unlikely to be an orderly process. In Athens, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
More than a million Haitians are still without homes since the massive earthquake that ripped apart that country last month. Many are living in tents, but the rainy season is coming in May, and hurricanes may follow. Today, the Miami-based company Innovita offered up a solution, small homes made of fiber composite panels. That's the hard stuff you've seen on airplanes around the interior walls and windows. Herb Margolis is the CEO of U.S. Operations.
The 787 Dreamliner fuselage is made from composite materials. Bulkheads are made from composite materials. These things fly at 40,000 feet and at 600-700 miles an hour or what have you. The stresses are incredible.
The company's pledged to build 1,000 homes and hopes to have a $15 million manufacturing facility in Haiti by year's end. Miami-based architect Andres Duane of the firm DPZ helped build cottages in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and now he's helping Innovita design homes for Haiti. Mr. Duane, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I'm trying to envision exactly what this might look like. Can you describe these homes for us?
Well, they're rectangular. They're 8 feet high and 8 feet wide, and they have a very large opening with a flap that opens up into a porch. So basically, the house itself contains the bathroom, the kitchen, or the toilet, 2 bedrooms with 8 beds. And, you know, they can paint it any color. They can add on to it. They can use it as a basic structure onto which to basically scab on additional rooms and materials. But it's, I think, something they would recognize as the kinds of place they live in.
And what are the challenges that you all face getting these homes built in terms of terrain and manpower and that sort of thing?
Well, the manpower is available. Haitians are well known to be hardworking. I think the challenge is there isn't one terrain. There's flat land, there's rolling land, and there are hillsides. But the single greatest challenge is how to get rid of waste, because they don't have much water. And so you can't flush a toilet, you see. And so what we've developed, or at least discovered, is some very high-tech material, specifically a kind of plastic bag that is made in Sweden, that you use, you seal, you know, you tie it up, and in 3 weeks it's compost, it's usable compost. So what we have going here is a combination of very low tech, you know, no glass, no air conditioning, barely running water, and very high tech.
Those images of the shanty towns down there have been really striking. Can these types of homes be sustainable in the long run?
Okay, well, that's a question. That's an interesting question. If one only provides the technical solution, which the UN has been doing for decades, and you study what the outcome is 5 years out, for example, in a book called by Ian Davis called Resilient Cities, and he says, if you don't fit the culture, people will inhabit the buildings at first because they do need the shelter, but then they'll trash them and abandon them. Even within the category called the poor in Haiti, there are at least four classes, and they behave differently. Some of them eat outside, some of them eat indoors, some of them have eat in front of the house, some of them cook and eat in the back of the house. Some of them have windows, and some of them don't want windows because they believe that spirits enter through the windows. All these things, because they're contradictory, have caused us to design not one, but four different houses.
Now, 1,000 shelters is a wonderful gift, but it's clearly not enough to serve the needs of so many Haitian homeless right now. What else needs to be done, and how long is it going to take to provide enough shelter for all those people?
Well, first of all, when you think of 1,000 shelters and you think of in terms of an American dwelling unit, that's not that much. But remember that each of our dwellings houses eight. So 1,000 shelters is 8,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's a big hit. What I suggest is that everybody who has an idea, you know, there are so many clever ways to build that are fast and cheap and so forth. I suggest that everybody have a go, because ours are dependent on donations. We can't promise more than 1,000. That's the reality, and many others have to step in.
Andres Duane is with the Miami architectural firm DPZ. Thank you very much, and good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
Coming up, cutting greenhouse gases isn't easy, but the recession helps.
We're not transporting as much stuff. We're not exporting as much stuff. And sadly, that means reaching the goals is actually easier.
But first, let's do the numbers. Ben Bernanke's pledge to keep interest rates low is a shot in the arm for Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped up 91 points. Or 0.9% to finish at 10,374. The NASDAQ climbed 22 points, that's 1%, to close at 2235. The S&P 500 added 10 points, nearly 1%, to end the day at 1105. Carnival Cruise Line sailed up 6.3% after announcing it'll raise prices on some routes because of increased demand. Royal Caribbean also shored up 7.5%. Hertz drove down nearly 8% after the rental car company projected lower sales in 2010. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.69%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world, the revival of smart begins at HBR.org. And by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations about Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases January data on durable goods orders, stuff that should last more than 3 years. A House Committee on Domestic Policy holds a hearing titled Foreclosures Continue, What Needs to Change in the Administration's Response. And the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission discusses the implications of U.S. debt to China. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. If times are really so tough for the big health insurance firm WellPoint, why do its corporate bosses seem to be thriving? That was the question from House Democrats today. They say at least 39 WellPoint execs have been paid salaries of $1 million or more, and the firm spent $27 million in 2 years on more than 100 executive retreats. Now it wants to boost rates up to 39% for its Anthem Blue Cross customers in California, and the Obama administration says that calls for slapping limits on health insurance costs. But commentator Robert Reich argues there's a better way.
Essentially, there are two ways to control rising health care costs, either regulate prices or subject providers to more competition. Unfortunately, the bills that emerged from the House and Senate don't do much of either. But President Obama has now come out mainly for regulating prices. The health care bill he unveiled Monday, which he'll push at tomorrow's bipartisan meeting, calls for government to set maximum rates health insurers can charge. Price regulation is always difficult, no matter whether it's a health insurer or an electric utility, because regulators have no way of knowing what's a reasonable rate. Set it too high, and companies get a windfall. Too low, and they can't stay in business. So typically, regulators set rates that cover reasonable costs plus a profit. The problem is, these sorts of regulations don't give companies any incentive to trim their costs and become more efficient. They just pass the costs on, like doctors who charge a fee for whatever services they provide. That's why I favor the alternative way to control costs, by way of competition. When companies have to compete for customers, they have a strong incentive to hold down prices and improve performance. One way to inject more competition into health insurance would be through a public insurance option that private insurers have to compete against. Another way is to remove the health insurance industry's exemption from the nation's antitrust laws. A third way is to give Medicare and Medicaid the power to shop for the best deals, forcing providers to compete, not only on prices, but on outcomes. A provider that can keep more people healthy at lower cost, regardless of their age or medical condition when they sign up, should get the contract. No one knows where healthcare reform is headed right now, or even if it's headed anywhere. But the best way to revive it is to focus on controlling costs. And the best way to control costs is through more competition, not more regulation.
Former Clinton Labor Secretary Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. We welcome your thoughts at marketplace.org. Today, President Obama asked a gathering of top CEOs to support his economic agenda, and high on his list is global warming. Obama said putting a price on carbon pollution is a critical part of moving toward clean energy. But if Vegas bookies were taking bets on passing a tough federal climate law this year, the odds wouldn't favor it. The Copenhagen talks already rolled snake eyes, and the recession and political resistance at home make serious greenhouse gas cuts unlikely. So what now? Here's Sarah Gardner from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Right now, it seems like the most effective global warming fighter is, frankly, the recession.
Ironically, the fact that the economy is in such weak condition helps with the emissions reduction goals.
Mary Nichols is a key environmental regulator in California.
Because we're not transporting as much stuff, we're not exporting as much stuff, you know, our factories are not working at the same pace and so forth. And sadly, that means reaching the goals that were in the Waxman-Markey legislation is actually easier.
Waxman-Markey is shorthand for climate legislation the House passed last year. Its main goal is deeply slashing heat-trapping pollutants from power plants, cars and the like, by mid-century. That's a tall order, even with the help of a feeble economy. And Senate passage of a strong climate bill is, at best, uncertain. Jeremy Simons at the National Wildlife Federation says without a federal limit on global warming emissions, the U.S. can kiss that goal goodbye.
At the end of the day, without a level playing field from the federal government to say, here's the game plan, if you invest in clean energy, you will profit, we'll see more of the same.
So without a federal mandate, can any progress be made? Conservationists say yes, but it's baby steps. Many states now require more of their electricity come from solar, nuclear, and wind, for example, and they are mandating more energy-efficient buildings and appliances. Harvard economist Robert Stavins says energy efficiency standards can cut greenhouse gases at a relatively low cost.
But only so much. If one wants to achieve the targets, for example, that people talk about for the U.S., which is reducing emissions by 2050, 80% below the 2005 levels, energy efficiency is absolutely not going to do it.
Same goes for those state laws on how much electricity should come from renewables. States don't want to enforce them too quickly because they can raise electricity prices too high too fast. That leaves two other alternatives. The EPA is planning to regulate global warming gases soon, but lawsuits are almost sure to bog that down. The other way is for states and regions to put their own caps on those emissions. Mary Nichols is helping to craft California's historic law to fight global warming.
It's not just a matter of can we do it or, you know, is it technically feasible, but can we do it in a way that does not disadvantage California or make us less competitive versus other states?
Nichols is hinting at resistance to these state efforts. California opponents are threatening a ballot initiative this fall to suspend the state's global warming law. And just this month, Arizona's governor pulled her state out of a regional program to limit greenhouse gases. She said it would cripple Arizona's economy. But even without a recession, Harvard's Robert Stavins says making big leaps to combat global warming is inherently problematic. He says typically it takes an ecological disaster that's easily observed and understood to pass groundbreaking environmental laws.
Climate is different than that, and it's different than the other environmental problems that we've dealt with in our democratic system.
Stavins says the slow drip nature of a warming planet isn't like, say, Ohio's Cuyahoga River catching fire in 1969. That event spurred a grassroots environmental movement in this country. He says combating climate change requires political leadership from the top taking chances. And that's why we haven't gotten too far. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Coney Island's iconic Ferris wheel is about to go green. The owners of the Wonder Wheel plan to outfit its 16 swinging cars with solar panels. Years ago, each of those cars used to be brightly lit until the electrical wiring on the 90-year-old attraction had to be abandoned because of safety concerns. Now each car will have its own little power supply, restoring the New York Carnival ride, the owners hope, to all its glittering glory. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 91 points, or 0.9%. The Nasdaq packed on 22 points, 1%. The S&P 500 gained 10 points, almost 1%. Vahan Baladuni, Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Andre Jackson-Gerwitz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, the perils of buying a cheaper home in the sticks.
The cost of housing was apparently low enough to attract people, but the cost of transportation is so high that they can't afford to live there anymore.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.